Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
But normally on a Friday, after a Thursday night football game, I crack open the mic, I look into these cameras, and I ask, what the hell did I just watch? Because whatever it is, I know it's not football. At least, not good football. But I'm sitting here today and I'm saying, what the hell did I just watch? Was that actually a good Thursday night football game? Now, I've had a few hours to think about it now, and you know what? I actually think it was. In fact, not only was that a good Thursday night football game, Eagles-Packers was flat-out good. A flat-out good game, period. However, period. I do have some questions coming out of that game, starting with, who the hell are the Eagles? Seriously, who are the Philadelphia Eagles? Are they the team that was getting humiliated by Washington in the opener, only to flip it on its head and light it up in the second half? Are they the team that lost to the Lions at home? Or are they the team that just went out on the road in a hostile environment with their backs to the wall and beat an undefeated Packers team? Like, I don't know, because for the first 15-plus minutes, they looked like a team that was about to drop to 1-3 and have their season end before September even ends. They couldn't move the ball. They couldn't stop Devontae Adams. And the Packers were rolling them up on a 15-play, 78-yard drive. They went midway in the first quarter into the start of the second. But they held the Packers, who were beginning to look unstoppable, to a field goal on that drive. And then all of a sudden, something clicked. Maybe the Eagles realized the entire city of Philly was freaking out. Their season was about to go up in flames. Maybe they remembered they were the Eagles and that they were the team that a lot of people were picking to be a Super Bowl contender. Maybe they remembered they were the team that put up 25 in the second half against Washington, not the one that got booed off the field in the first. In other words, the Eagles team that everybody expected all offseason finally showed up in the second quarter of week four. The defense finally started to get after Aaron Rodgers.
Under center, fake the handoff. Rodgers is sacked and loses the football. Philadelphia's got it. On the scoop, Brandon Graham. The Packers turn it over deep in their own territory.
That's Westwood One. Philadelphia then started to feed Jordan Howard and kept feeding Jordan Howard. Remember when Bears fans were trying to say that Jordan Howard was so overrated? Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. He may not be flashy, but he does work. Big time work. And Jordan Howard can get you the hard yards.
Single setback, Howard. Shotgun, Wentz. Wentz, handoff. Howard, left side run. He's in. Touchdown. Jordan Howard angles in for the score.
Plus, Jordan Howard can get you the easiest yards.
Once again, looks that way, floats it. Room for Howard, down the sideline. A walk-in touchdown. Wentz connects for 20 yards. Jordan Howard.
And Jordan Howard can get you the hardest yards of all.
Howard in the backfield. Philadelphia looking to break the tie. Wentz under center. Two receivers to the right. They have pounded the football in this second half. On the ground. Give it to Howard. Up the middle. Second effort. Hammers it in. Touchdown. Eagles.
115 yards from scrimmage, three TDs in a game Philadelphia absolutely had to have. That was a brass performance by Howard. In fact, by everybody in Philly gear. Howard was eating up yards and catching passes, unlike Aguilar.
We was catching them, unlike Aguilar.
Then you got Miles Sanders, right? Miles Sanders was big, both in the backfield and with a huge return in the second quarter, which sparked everything. The offensive line dominated, and Doug Peterson did what he does, win on Thursday night and find an opponent's weakness and exploit it. In this case, it was Green Bay's left side. Sanders said, quote, Doug Peterson's plan was just to keep pounding the ball, and that opened up more stuff, and when we needed to pass the ball, we were able to do it, and we got first down. Downs, big thanks to the O-line. They played their ass off the whole game, opening up holes for us, end quote. Again, a massive performance by everybody on the road, down double digits without key players in a must-win game. Even the Eagle fans showed up and showed out at Lambeau, chanting, Cowboys suck, Cowboys suck, when they saw Michael Irvin doing his analyst work. You see what the Eagles did in the final three quarters of that game and the way they gashed a supposedly great Packers defense, and you think, this team definitely has a look at a Super Bowl, especially when they get healthier. I mean, yeah, Philadelphia has issues in the secondary. Rodgers threw all over them, and by the end of that game, they were about ready to start pulling Philly fans out of the stands to line them up in the dime package. But they still found a way to come up with not one, but two goal line stands in the fourth quarter. So you look at that crew that showed up after they fell behind 10-0 on the road, and you think, man, this team is for real. Philly is for real. But then you think, why are they falling behind by 10 in every single game? Because that's what Philly's doing too. They trailed by double digits in every game this season. And still somehow they managed to win two of their four games. They have perfected the art of the slow start. They've only scored points in the first quarter of one game this year. But they are really good at allowing points early on, especially on their opponent's opening drives. I guess what I'm saying is, can you imagine how good they'd be if they actually showed up from the opening kick, could get healthy, and stop spotting everybody 10 points? So again, back to my original question, which team are they? The ones that fall behind and eventually lose to the Lions, or the one that falls behind and finds a way to beat the Packers? Are they a Super Bowl contender, or are they a team that's not even going to make the postseason? Are they really good, or are they really average? Right now, the answer is yes. But I'm leaning towards closer to being really good. And they did what they had to do. And for the Packers, I'll get to them in a moment. 3-1 is not the end of the world, but make no mistake, that was a blown opportunity. They should be 4-0. They got their soul snatched. You got to win that game if you're Green Bay. In terms of Philadelphia, down 10-0, nobody gripped, nobody panicked. Carson Wentz said, man, this group is tough.
Resilient team. You know, unfortunately, we've been plagued with a lot of injuries, you know, both sides of the ball. And we'll see, you know, what that looks like going forward for this team. But a resilient bunch. It's kind of what we knew. Knew we had a lot of good depth and good ability, but the resiliency has been good to see.
I am really impressed with the way they came back. We are joined by Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. Dave, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Romy, my brother, I'm doing well. I'm on my way to San Francisco to three games set with the Giants and get ready for this postseason.
Absolutely love it. Great to have you back, Dave. Thanks for spending some time with us. Let me start you off with Clayton Kershaw, who had six shutout innings. He struck out seven. He allowed just two hits in that 1-0 win over the Padres. As you get ready for the postseason, how impressed were you with what you saw from Kershaw yesterday?
I was pumped. I was excited for him. And, you know, I was posed the question, did he need it? And I don't think he needed it, but I think that anytime you can throw up zeros going into the postseason to sort of build on that confidence is always a good thing. He commanded the fastball. The slider was right on point. And so he's locked and loaded. He'll be ready. He'll be ready to make your start. Haven't decided which game he's going to pitch yet, but he'll be ready.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later on. We'll talk about the rotation and how you set that up. Dave Roberts joining us. You know, that one run of the game came when Chris Taylor scored from first on a Max Muncy single. Dave, Muncy went from being a guy who was grinding, just trying to get major league at bats, to somebody who hit 35 home runs last season in his first full season. He hit 34 this year. He got to the All-Star game while playing first, second, and third base. What is it about Muncy that makes him so unique, so special?
Well, I think it's that blue-collar Texas college player. 3 years ago, he was contemplating, you know, not playing baseball again. And so there's that sense of gratitude. There's that toughness. And obviously the baseball acumen, and now you bake in the slug. And I just don't know where we'd be without this guy. And 3 years ago, he's out of baseball. And now he's an all-star in home run derbies and things like that. And, you know, a big cog in one of the best teams in all of baseball.
We're talking to Dave Roberts. Gratitude to me is a really interesting word because you've won your fourth division in four seasons as manager. I understand that you've got bigger goals for the season, but have you allowed yourself a moment to step back and take in that accomplishment?
Romy, unfortunately, I have not. I guess I'm guilty of just being in the moment and trying to get to the next moment and keep your head down. And at some point in time, I think I'm going to look back and appreciate what we've accomplished. But right now, and even looking back at the 4 years, I'm just focused on the Giants right now and trying to make sure Walker Buehler pitches well tonight.
I get it. Hey, clones, 1 out of 4 batteries are going to fail this winter. Get yours tested for free during Superstar Battery Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. If it does need to be replaced, O'Reilly has the Superstar Battery for you. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. Dodgers manager Dave Roberts joining us. I get that, but let me ask you this. Like, you guys are managing to make it look pretty easy when it's not easy. It's not as easy as just running out the same lineup 4 years in a row and dominating because the team has changed, it's grown, it's evolved over that time. Dave, how does this year's team compare to the ones that have come before it?
You know what, Romy, first thing is that I appreciate you saying it's not easy because, you know, to keep a team hungry and focused, there's talent everywhere in baseball. And to discount what the organization has done is unfair. There's a lot of good players, but I think that it's a very focused group. I think that obviously losing in the World Series 2 years in a row certainly adds to that incentive. But even without that, even if we had won 2, Romy, this is a focused group that wants to get better each day. They care about each other. We play the game the right way, and obviously we're very talented.
You know, at the same time, Dave, I don't think that it's a given, right? I mean, you're at that high level, and there's some unfinished business, but teams are not supposed to stay as hungry and motivated as this team has been over the past 4 years. So how do you go about managing the drive and the hunger aspect of that clubhouse?
I think it's a more micro focus and just getting guys to finally buy into that in the sense of, you know, just the day-to-day. Once you win the World Series, I've been a part of a World Series team and seen teams that have won the World Series, and you kind of lose that edge. And so just to have that micro focus, you see, I think adds to that. But I just – these guys are really smart. They care about each other. And they take pride, Romy, and you see our guys play a lot and playing the game the right way and playing hard. And we got a lot of blue-collar players.
Dave Roberts joining us on the program. Dave, I had Terry Francona on last week, and he was talking about how no matter how long he's been doing this or how long he's been in the game, extra inning games in September are still exciting. They still give him the juice. What's it like for you when the postseason rolls around? Does it ever become routine, or do you still get that same level of excitement for every postseason game?
Absolutely. I'll pass on the September extra inning games, especially the 19-inning game the Cardinals and the Diamondbacks went through. But the postseason, yes, that's what it's all about. Your juices are going. Every pitch is important. This is what guys work for in the offseason, in spring training, and you're putting together rosters and scouting and game planning and for that, how everything is on the biggest stage. And you know, when you're the only team and two teams are playing in the World Series and everyone in the world is watching you, there's no better feeling than that. So that's what you play for.
Dave Roberts joining us for a few more moments. Dodgers and Giants getting ready. Dave, go back to the pitching if you don't mind. Coming off Kershaw's performance yesterday, one of the natural questions, of course, has been about setting the rotation. How do you go about approaching those decisions and setting the order?
You know, I think that when you're talking about Clayton Kershaw, Hyun-Jin Ryu, and Walker Buehler, these are three players that deserve the conversations as far as where they're going to slot in. And for us as an organization, myself, Rick Honeycutt, to let these guys know where we feel best for them, what's going to help us win that division series against a particular opponent. So we got Walker going today, Hyun-Jin tomorrow. So that flexibility, Romy, we still have 1, 2, and 3. We're going to have that conversation this weekend, but I really don't know. It's kind of open-ended, but I think that looking at three aces, we can't really make a bad decision.
Right. How about the back end? Kenley Jansen had back-to-back saves earlier in the week. Dave, how does he look to you right now, and how do you go about preparing to use him in the postseason?
Kenley looks great. Kenley looks great. I think he's taken a lot of warranted, unwarranted criticism, but he's my guy, he's our guy, and his last one was really good. I do got to talk to him, Romy, about calling a front office and analytics guy scientist, but that quote, I didn't get that quote. But you know what? Kenley's a guy like most superstars. There are certain things that fuel their fire, that motivate them, and Kenley is a very motivated player right now. And Romy, we need him if we're going to get that ring.
It's kind of funny, Dave. I mean, scientists, what a great way to put that. Scientists. How do you explain to him that the game has kind of changed and that we need these, quote, scientists? These scientists have good information for us?
You know what, man? It's just sometimes, Romy, you just got to laugh. And, you know, always great players don't always make good coaches or GMs. They're great for a reason. So we got to clean that verbiage up. But I think our guys, Romy, are very good at accepting information and seeing that front office, analytics guys, R&D guys in our clubhouse, they're there for the same reason they are. You know, that's to help win a championship. And we get that cohesiveness, I think, more than anyone, and it's good to see.
Dave Roberts, my guest. All right, one last thought. You're going to close out the regular season in San Francisco. You're on your way, which means you're going to face Bruce Bochy for the final time as a Giants manager. You and the Dodgers organization already paid tribute to him in his last visit to Dodger Stadium. What kind of an impact has Boch had on you, Dave?
Oh, Romy, he's one of my good friends, former manager, friend, obviously, shared wine together, dinners, our wives are friendly, managed against him, and his in-game, Romy, is next level. He just does things. He's always ahead of you, and there was a game the last series. I got out-managed. You know, there was an in-game move that I wasn't prepared for, and, you know, you're always kind of, sometimes people say that Boch is playing chess and you're playing checkers, and that's why he's on his way to the Hall of Fame. And I'm going to miss him. I'm looking forward to being there for his last few games here at AT&T Park. And what he's meant to the game of baseball for me individually, it's been great. And I look forward to his ascension to Cooperstown.
Really well said. I'll second that. What a great, great manager. Great baseball man. Dodgers manager Dave Roberts, in his fourth season, he was the 2016 NL Manager of the Year, and they've won that division 4 years in a row, and they have some unfinished business. They're right back at it at San Francisco. Dave, I appreciate you so much. Great to have you back in the jungle. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Romy, we'll talk soon.
As good as that win was for Philadelphia, that was a soul-crushing loss for the Packers. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not smashing the panic button on that team. But that was a bad night for a number of reasons, starting with their allegedly Super Bowl caliber defense that we'd all been hyping through the first 3 weeks. Considering the Packers were ranked 25th against the run coming in, maybe we should have known better. I know Doug Peterson did. He spotted the weakness in that defense, the left side, and he exploited it. And it was not hard to do. They gashed the Packers on the ground to the tune of 176 yards at home. And the thing is, it didn't start out that way. It actually started off really well. The crowd was hyped. The Packers scored early on to go up 7-0. Then they go on a monster drive, starting on their own 10. The offense was finding its rhythm. It felt like the offense had finally caught up with the defense. Davante Adams was unstoppable. The rest of the NFC was on notice until they got into the red zone and stalled out and had to settle for a field goal. And if this were a movie, get ready, clones. Here comes a big word. If this were a movie, that would be foreshadowing, because the red zone issues would only get worse, much worse, which I'll get back to in a second, because there were still a few highlights for Packer fans to enjoy. How about Jimmy Graham fighting off some dings, fighting off some injury, and making this ridiculous play from Rodgers?
Second and 10. Adams, 13 targets, 9 catches. Graham, touchdown, Green Bay.
Thanks to NFL and Fox. Every single time Aaron Rodgers steps on the field, even now, he still does something amazing. And he makes it look easy. And there was nothing easy about that. He's backpedaling on that throw, practically running backwards, and he still makes that throw and still puts it right into Graham's hands between a couple of defenders. It's a joke. That was a joke in the best way possible. Unfortunately, the Packers' rushing offense was comical too, but in the worst way possible. Green Bay just couldn't run the ball. Could not run the ball. Every time they tried to run the ball, it was like a gift to the Eagles. Aaron Rodgers should be your leading passer. Aaron Rodgers should not be your leading rusher, but he was. And don't confuse this. This is a very mobile quarterback, even at that age. He's a threat when he's on the move. I get that. But you do not want your Hall of Fame quarterback, one who had a busted collarbone a couple of times, to also be your only effective runner. That said, my man can still run it.
Rodgers feeling pressure again. Bradham can't bring him down, and Rodgers has got a first down. Came in with 5 carries for 7 yards. He also came in with 215 rushing first downs.
Totally maddening for a defense.
He can still run it. The problem was he had to run it. The other problem was the Packer defense can't stop the run. Again, that crew got so much hype through the first 3 weeks, but they had some issues with the run coming in, and it got worse and worse as the game went on. Not only that, but the Packers' red zone issues got worse because with just over 9 minutes left in the fourth, Green Bay's down 7. They've got first and goal at the 1. First and goal at the 1 at home, down 7. Incomplete pass, incomplete pass, incomplete pass, incomplete pass, turnover on downs. I mean, how brutal is it? Matt LaFleur has to wear that. I know they were having issues running the ball. And if any of those passes were completed, we're not having this conversation right now. But none of the passes were completed. And if you're an NFL team, you've got to be able to get 1 yard on the ground from the 1 yard line. I don't care what defense you're going up against. You've got to be able to scheme or will your way to 1 yard. All of that said, you knew how this game was going to end. Even after that, no matter how many issues that defense had, no matter how awkward the running game had been, Aaron Rodgers was going to lead them on a late drive in the fourth to tie the game or to win it. And he was doing it. Green Bay takes over with 5 minutes left on their own 11. They're down by 7. Rodgers to Graham for 12. Rodgers to Aaron Jones for 2. Rodgers scrambles for 11. They keep chipping away. They're moving the ball down the field. They're moving it to the inevitable. First and goal from the 7. Give it to Jones for 4. Setting up second and goal from the 3. You know, and then they're in no rush. They're confident. They're good. You know what's going to happen next. Rodgers will find somebody wide open in the end zone. They tie the game. They win it in overtime. Or they just go for 2 and they win it right there. We all know this. It's inevitable. Roll it.
Rodgers has been in this situation so many times. Rodgers back. He pumps, he fires. It is intercepted on the deflection. Intercepted. Eagles have the ball. Nigel Bradham out across the 20. And this game is as good as over.
Eagles radio. But before that play, even they sounded like they knew what was going to happen. And they didn't know that was going to happen. And I still can't believe that. I mean, a hell of a play by Philly. And the ultimate record scratch for Packer fans. That's not how that game was supposed to end. Not at home. Not with that defense. Not with the offense showing signs of getting into rhythm. Not with your vintage Aaron Rodgers throwing for more than 400 yards. Again, hell of a play by the Eagle defense. Maybe getting there a little bit early, but what is pass interference these days? Yeah, why don't we just stop on that for a minute? No, I mean, seriously, what is pass interference these days? Because I don't know. Not when the replay officials are overruling an offensive pass interference to give a touchdown to Philly and then seeing nothing when Marquez Valdez-Scantling was manhandled. Here's what I do know about pass interference. The replay rules designed to make things better after the Rams and the Saints have made everything worse. Exactly what everybody predicted. Everybody saw this coming, and the only ones who didn't were the people in the league office who mattered the most. The pass interference rule is the new catch rule, and it's awful. But not nearly as awful as how Packer fans had to be feeling after they let that game get away. It was right there for them. Get to 4-0. Keep stretching that lead in the NFC North, knowing that the Vikings and the Bears are playing on Sunday, and one of them is going to get another loss. Instead, you're 3-1, and you took a gut punch loss that's going to live with them for a little bit. And on top of that, Devontae Adams has turf toe. They've got questions about their defense, especially their run defense, and questions about their offense. All around, a pretty crappy end to a night that started so well. Again, 3-1 is not the end of the world, but 4-0 is a hell of a lot better. And that's exactly what they should be right now. And with your hotshot, offensive-minded, new young head coach, how come they can't run the ball at all? First and goal from the one, four incomplete passes. How can you not get 1 yard down there when you have to have it? Clones, what do you want when you're craving protein or you need more energy? I'll tell you what you don't want or need. Bars, sugary snacks, energy drinks. No, what you want is beef, pure and simple. So where is the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your dad's jerky. Shriveled, dry, tasteless. No, Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It's tender, it's tasty, it's not tough. So why is it so good? Because Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for its relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein. It comes in four great flavors to satisfy all your cravings. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes wherever you go, to the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere. So look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you see the quality that you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? So we have a lot to get caught up on with Jared Allen. Jared, what's going on? Good to have you on the program. How are you?
Hey, good to be on your program again, buddy.
My man, Jared. So much to talk to you about. We've got football. We've got your nonprofit work. Of course, we have curling, which I'm going to break down. But before we get into all of that, how is life for Jared Allen right now?
Oh, life's not too bad. I'm actually talking to you from the golf course. So, you know what? I'm just mastering retirement. That's what I'm doing.
Good man. So how you hitting him? How's the golf course treating you?
I've been playing really well today. This is one of those that helps my handicap out a little bit, you know? Raise me back up.
Good man. Jared Allen joining us. All right, so let me ask you about the Vikings. They're facing the Bears in Chicago on Sunday. Jared, everybody talks about the NFC North and how tough that division is. How different are NFC North division games compared to every other game?
I mean, it is really different. I mean, every division has a thing. I remember when I was in the AFC West that had its challenges too, right? I think once you get into a division, you're so familiar with a team, you're so familiar with a city, you're so familiar with that, then you have all those kind of bugaboos that come with it as well. You know, going for us with the Vikings, like going to Green Bay was always a challenge to win there. And I think I can't remember the last time that the Vikings actually won in Chicago. It's been, if they did, it's been one time in the last probably decade. So, it always has these challenges because you're fighting these traditions, you're fighting stigmas of the years past. And then everybody seems to play their best game when you're in the division and playing against each other. And it's always made for good football. It's made for good rivalries. And the fans dig it. And the North, plus, it's known to be cold and physical. So we try to get after it and live up to that.
Jared Allen is joining us. Jared, you played six seasons with the Vikings. You know how passionate that fan base is. Knowing how badly that team and that fan base wants a Super Bowl, how much pressure is there on Kirk Cousins this year?
It's a ton. He came into a tough situation. He came into, a team that just went to the AFC Championship with Case Keenum. You get a fully guaranteed contract. And it kind of from a fan standpoint, you got to look at that as Super Bowl or bust, right? Obviously, the pressure's off. He accepted all the criticism he could last year for not making the playoffs. I think that franchise, that fan base is deserving. And that defense, even when I was there, it seems to be, kind of a tradition with Minnesota defenses, especially that front seven, just always being in the tops of the league. And I think overall, like when I was there the last probably 10 years, they've been probably top 15 in every category. I think the pressure is on them for the offense to step up and make that run. And again, I think it's a tough situation they came into, but that's the name of this game. And the Vikings fan base, obviously, when they brought Kurt in there, they brought a recognizable name, hoping to get a franchise quarterback. And they want to get past where they were with Case in the years before.
We're talking to Jared Allen. So, Jared, you've got the Vikings and the Bears this weekend. When you played and you went from the Vikings to the Bears, what was that like when you faced your old team?
You know what? It's always fun. You're gonna have excitement. I remember when I went back to Kansas City. There's a sense of nostalgia there. And then to play with the Bears. Probably more so, I think I felt bad playing for the Bears, going back and playing as the Vikings. I had so many great memories. I always considered myself a Viking. Never had plans of leaving the Vikings. And, you know, things happen in free agency, and you're always, everybody's chasing a ring, right? So you're trying to find the best opportunity to find a get to the Super Bowl. So, you know what? It's always nostalgic. It's fun. And I think, you know, when you return to play against an old team, you tend to step it up and play a little bit harder.
Hey, Chair, before I ask you about what you're doing right now, one final thought about this, because it's been a couple of years since you retired. So what's your relationship with football like these days? Do you ever get the itch to get back out there and play?
No, you know, Sundays are always fun, right? But if I had to go to the track of the training camp, I'd probably blow my L5 for a third time. Probably rip two hamstrings. You know, me and Ruth always joke about it. I was like, can you imagine if you had to get down to the stands and fire off the ball right now? So I'm perfectly content being retired. I don't ever get the itch. I barely watch football games. You know, I keep up enough with it just because I still know some of the people playing. But other than that, man, I'm too busy, you know, raising babies and trying to chase that Olympic dream.
Okay, let's talk about the Olympic dream. Jared Allen is my guest. Now, clearly you are staying busy. You're making babies. You're raising babies. You're chasing the Olympic dream. And curling is a big part of this. For those who do not know, you said that in the past, a lot of things that you've done in your life are the result of an idea or maybe a bet that you made. How did a bet about golf lead to curling?
Yeah, you know what? A bet about golf parlayed into me watching Eddie the Eagle to sitting by my fire pit with my buddy and somehow thinking I could possibly make an Olympic sport sometime. Cool part is I never laid down a time frame for it. So, you know, I know it's one of those things everybody's kind of like, that's kind of arrogant to think you're in the Olympics, but that's not the case. The case is it gives us a challenge. It's something fun to chase, something fun to do. And you got to have serious goals. You know, I told my dad when I was 8, I was going to play in the NFL. You know, most people are like, yeah, okay, whatever, kid. But that's what drove me. So the same thing. I like to set incredibly high goals and see if I can't make it.
All right. So Jared, was the idea to become an Olympic curler or just an Olympian of any sort?
No, it was an Olympian of any sort. So I looked at curling, and curling was the one sport that we hadn't fared that well at. And this was way before Schuster won the gold, right? So at that point, we hadn't done very well. It was either that or badminton. I figured badminton was going to be way too physically taxing. And then, right. You know, curling was like, most people start when they're 40s. And even if I lose, the winners have to buy me a beer, so that's not half bad.
Right.
I figured it was a win-win. And then all of a sudden, you know, we were training under the radar, and then Schuster and them go and make this run to the gold. The cool part about curling is everybody's super welcoming. They love, you know, the attention we bring to the sport. And I think we pay it respect by putting in the hours. We put in the hours, we put in the work. And I tell you what, it's going to be once we get over that little hump, it's going to be downhill from there. People better look out.
Jared Allen joining us. You know, Jared, you've got some former NFLers on that team. You guys are all elite athletes. Can you athlete your way to being an elite curler? Like, how much does your athleticism pay off in that sport?
So the athleticism pays off from learning the technique of curling, right? Sliding on the ice, sweeping, all that stuff. But what you can't athletically your way to is the, you know, 30 years of strategy these guys are imploring into the game. So it's a little more than shuffleboard on ice. I like to consider like shuffleboard combined with chess, right, and geometry, because every little angle means something. And then, but yeah, at the end of the day, we try to dumb it down, right? We try to keep it simple. And, you know, wherever the skip holds the broom, hit the broom, you know, aim at the broom, throw the right, you know, speed of the rock, and pray the shot goes where it needs to go.
Jared, curling's got that rap that it's boring, especially when you compare it to the NFL. What is your response when you hear that?
Oh, well, I repeat that.
Curling is boring, right? It's got that rap that it's really
boring. Oh, yeah. You know what? It's actually better to watch on TV. There needs to be an education part. Like, playing it is phenomenal. Playing it is really fun. People that love curling love watching it. They understand it. They literally sit at the glass and they drink beer and have a good time. So, but if you have somebody on TV explaining it, like, I always watch it during the Olympics. I think it's one of those novelty sports that it's great, right? Playing it's an absolute blast, but yes, I have to admit, curling is not the greatest, funnest sport to watch. I'm trying to change that. I'm trying to see if they can get some, like, live announcing, you know what I mean? Get some people banging on the glass like hockey. So.
That's exactly what you should do, Jared. Listen, before you go, you're continuing your work with Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors. How is that work going, and how much does that work mean to you?
That's great. I mean, like I said, I've been doing that now for 10 years. Couldn't have had to go back, but I mean, you're giving away, you know, close to like 20 homes. You know, we just gave another home away last week. We just broke ground on another one. So it's just been it's a continual process. And like I said, we have a great team, great partnerships. We've been doing it for 10 years, and I can't thank everybody enough for believing in the dream that I had and making it a reality. And, you know, we just keep chugging along.
Such good cause. And then finally, the goal for you was the 2022 Olympics. Now that you've been in this for a little while, does that feel realistic to you? Are we going to see you in Beijing in 2022?
Is it realistic? No. Is it a possibility? Yes, because everything's a possibility, and I will do whatever it takes to get it done. So, although, you know, 2026 is in, like, Italy. So Italy seems a little cooler than Beijing, so maybe we'll shoot for that one. But
all right, then.
That's our goal. You know, in a weird way, our curling is awesome. I got invited to Nationals last year to be an alternate with Rich Runin's team, and we took second place. So I technically am a silver medal national curler. So it's pretty awesome. I got the medal to prove it.
Technically, that is awesome. He spent 12 years in the NFL. He is the founder of Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors and now living the Olympic dream. Jared, great to get caught up. Appreciate you and always good to talk to you on the program.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
He is John Morosi. John, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I'm outstanding. Thanks, as always, for the generous introduction. I'm joining you now from a place I don't think I've ever actually done live radio, and that would be East 42nd Street in New York. I'm about to head over to Citi Field as we begin our preparations for tomorrow's broadcast of the Braves and the Mets. And so I'm actually joining you live from East 42nd Street. So greetings from New York, my friend.
Greetings. That is macho. In fact, I will be flying to New York tomorrow. So bring me up to date. How is the city? Give me a weather forecast. What's it feel like?
It is gorgeous, Jim. In fact, I was speaking to one friend today who lives here and said that this might be the best September of weather they can ever remember seeing here. So it's been absolutely glorious. Blue sky today. I wish you could say the same thing for the Mets playoff chances, of course, that they have been eliminated as the Braves are now division champions in the NL East once again. But great vibe in the city. Certainly a lot of, I would say, lots of motorcades here with the UN going out. So it's got that excitement happening too. But it's been a really, really fun week to be in the city. And again, this is, I think, a special time. There's always a great time to be in New York. But I think this time of year, as the Yankees on the other side of town, of course, anticipate and celebrate, thinking about this, Jim, their first AL East division title since 2012. It's been 7 years. So a great chance for them to advance to the American League playoffs and a great buzz in the city all the way around.
Good. Good to hear it. John Morosi is joining us. So why don't we start you right there with the Yankees. Luis Severino is going to be going tomorrow night in Texas. When you look, John, at what he did in his last outing against Tampa Bay, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Jim, I think he's got a chance to be one of their very, very key pitchers in the postseason. And I think you consider what he's been able to do this year when he's been healthy now, just the last couple outings out and having missed the first five-plus months of the season. The stuff that he has shown since coming back has been very encouraging indeed. And when you consider the Yankees' other options, not really having very many guys that go deep into games at this point in time, I think Aaron Boone's going to have to ride him, hopefully, into the fifth or the sixth inning at the very least, because you have that luxury, Jim, of a great bullpen. And given where the Yankees are, even without Dellin Betances, they've got a tremendous amount of relief pitching to throw at guys late in the game. And so I think if you get your starter in really through six is optimal. That's about as long as I believe any Yankee starter has to go in these playoffs is six innings. And I think even five plus could be acceptable in certain cases. Now, the big question, too, is going to be what's CC Sabathia's role on this team in the postseason? How much are they going to trust Jay Happ? They're probably going to face off against the Minnesota Twins, a team that we know, Jim, has set the record for home runs. First ever to surpass 300 by any MLB team in a season. So if the Yankee pitching is not on point, and if Severino is not close to himself being able to keep the ball in the ballpark, it could be a very tough first-round assignment against those slugging Minnesota Twins.
John Morosi is joining us. John, let me keep you on that topic for one more moment, because to that point that the Yankees, they don't need guys to go really deep into games because of the point that you referenced. They've got that bullpen. The Astros, on the other hand, can line up one great starter after another. So when you look at the way the game is played right now, and especially in the postseason, what would you rather have, New York's bullpen or Houston's rotation?
It's a great question, Jim. I think that in general, right now, I would rather have Houston's rotation because it allows you to organize your pitching in a much more orderly way, and I think is more sustainable over the full postseason run. You look at what the Red Sox did last year, and while you had a starter throwing the last pitch of the season as a reliever in Chris Sale, they were able to have success, I believe, because of that rotation and because of the adaptability of that rotation. When you consider what Eovaldi did in relief, what Sale did in relief, the struggles of Craig Kimbrell. The Red Sox won that World Series in only five games, by the way, despite the fact that their bullpen was not really on point. And I think that was instructive to me as to what I'd rather have right now. I would point out with the Astros, a big start tonight for Jose Urquidy, who may actually be able to become their fourth starter because of Wade Miley's struggles here in the month of September. So, you know, 1-2-3, you know that very well, Verlander, Cole, and Greinke. But I think the fourth game is a little bit uncertain, and that little bit of uncertainty, though, I still believe, Jim, is not going to be enough to derail the Astros. I believe the Astros are the team to beat in the American League and potentially the entire major leagues as the playoffs begin. They're the best team I see 1-25, even though I'm a little bit worried, Jim, about the fact that Carlos Correa out for the weekend and has not really played in the last week or so. His status is expected to be able to play in the division series, but some concern about that back issue that has been nagging him for much of the season.
John Morosi joining me from New York City. John, one more thought and a follow on that. 1-25 then, how would you compare the Astros roster this year with the one that won the World Series? How do they stack up? Could this one be better than the one that won it all?
I think it actually is, top to bottom. I think the interesting thing for me is the emergence of Yordan Alvarez, the rookie that has really been a revelation for them as a DH. Does not have a lot of defensive value, but he can really hit. And they also have Michael Brantley as well playing left field. And Brantley is a really tremendously respected player in this game. Solid lefty bat. All-star, of course, this year. He went back to Cleveland where he'd become a star for the All-Star game. So I think because of the lefty bats of Alvarez and Brantley, I think it's a deeper lineup. Altuve maybe not quite as explosive as he was 2 years ago, but still a dynamic player. And Bregman is probably even better. And there's a lot of MVP buzz around Alex Bregman right now. So I think overall it's a better team. I wonder about the one thing I would say is the pitching on that team, Jim, was so adaptable where you saw Morton McCullers throwing in relief. I don't think we're going to see Justin Verlander getting a save in a game 7 of the ALCS, for example. Wouldn't rule it out, but I think that maybe the age of the Astros' current dynamic rotation might preclude them from bouncing back on short rest and in relief roles quite as capably as Morton and McCullers did 2 years ago.
John Morosi doing what he does. We've got him for a few more moments. John, I have to ask you about Milwaukee. I mean, there are a number of teams dealing with injuries at the moment, but starting with the good news, the Brewers were supposed to be finished when they lost Christian Yelich, but they've turned it around. They're now in the postseason. How in the world do you explain that?
That's a great question, Jim. It's one of the best stories in baseball, probably in all of sports, in this last month of September, because you're right. When Yelich went down, I think a lot of people said, well, the Brewers had a nice run. They're a really likable team, but this is the end for them. And they've really been able to rebound. I think that the key thing for them was around the time that Yelich went out, they got back Keston Hira. And you'd be hearing a lot more about Keston Hira if it weren't for Pete Alonso's incredible record-setting rookie season in terms of home runs, because Hira, since the time he's come up, has been not quite the power hitter that Alonso is, but he's been every bit the offensive presence of Alonso during the time in which he's been healthy. So getting Hira back and being able to bat him fourth, he's really helped carry this team. They've had some really nice contributions from some of their call-ups in the minor leagues. Even Travis Shaw, who was such a key guy on that team last year, sent down to the minor leagues this year for a little bit of time. He has come back and contributed. They called up Cody Spangenberg. He has come up and done a very, very good job. So it's been a collective effort. Mike Moustakas continues to be a phenomenally professional player and really doing a lot of the same things he's done for the Royals in the past and for the Brewers last year. So I'm really impressed by the collective effort. They've got a great manager in Craig Counsell. The bullpen has really solidified itself with names like Guerra that maybe we weren't as familiar with when the season began. Adrian Hauser's been so good for them in the rotation. So it's been a really collective effort by a lot of unsung heroes and a pretty remarkable story when you consider that they've passed the Cubs. The Brewers passing teams like the Cubs, the Mets, the Phillies. That is why you may see two of those three teams or maybe three of those three teams changing managers in the next week.
All right, speaking of managers, quickly, I had Dave Roberts, John, on the program the first hour. We talked about his team, but we also talked about Bruce Bochy, who is going to be facing for the final time as the Giants manager this weekend. As somebody who has covered baseball for a long time, what do you think it is that makes Bochy as good as he is?
Well, Jim, he is a special person in the history of the game. His longevity, of course, he both managed and played with the great Hall of Famer Tony Gwynn. I think Bruce Bochy is someone who you look at his presence and his gravitas. He's got such stature, and you would think that he might be this loud and almost intimidating figure. But in fact, he's the opposite. He's incredibly easy to talk to. His smile, his sense of humor, very disarming, and he has a way of making everybody around him, whether you're a media member, a player, fan, executive, feel very comfortable. Dusty Baker has had that same quality to him. And I think that you saw Bruce's players respond to him so well. You think about the arcs of some of the players that he's had. Barry Zito, Tim Lincecum, Pablo Sandoval. The 2010 team had guys that have been released by other clubs and came to San Francisco and starred under Bruce Bochy. He has a way of inspiring trust in his players, and then he trusts them in return. And it's a really fascinating dynamic to watch happen. He's done it with young players, old players. He's a great credit to the game. And, Jim, he has probably not done managing yet. And by that I mean this. He has been asked to manage the national team of his birth country. Yes, France, in the World Baseball Classic qualifier next March. So international baseball update there. Bruce Bochy may well be managing the French national team next March in a bid to qualify for the 2021 World Baseball Classic.
A spectacular note to finish on. Remember, John Morosi can be seen on MLB Network's MLB Central weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. Plus, MLB Network is going to exclusively air two American League Division Series games next week. He is already in New York. John, great to have you back. Have an amazing weekend, and I know I'll run you down soon.
Jim, my pleasure. Sounds great. And next time we talk, we'll revisit the issues of my local football team there in Ann Arbor. We'll see how they look on Saturday against Rutgers.
Previously on Lost.
Dude, you're on. Hope you had a tremendous weekend. Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. Lots to get done.
Bills Mafia, where are you?
A ton of NFL, a ton of college football.
Let's start with the NFL weekend.
Yeah! Hit at the 39-yard line. Yikes.
Yes, I wanted to play call.
And the crowd hates that call.
Bad call.
I'm not jumping off that bandwagon. I didn't after they got punched in the face by the Titans in the opener, and I'm not right now. This is not about the Browns losing. It's about the Rams winning. Give them some freaking credit. It's a good win for the Rams.
Austin Knox breaks a few tackles.
Jordan Poyer joining us.
Stiff arm one dude and then chuck another dude and get the first down. It gave us a little bit more juice to come back and win the game.
Touchdown, Wisconsin 72.
I'm embarrassed about that.
They're paying him Nick Saban money for Brady Hoke results. Outplayed, outcoached, outtuffed, and outclassed is a terrible way to go through life, Michigan fan.
Who's got it better than us?
Everybody! We're talking to Pete Thamel.
I ripped Harbaugh as a lot of people did after that game just for the systemic failures that Michigan had, and they believe they should be competing for Big Ten championships. This version of Michigan is clearly not going to do that.
I'm good. Okay. Thank you.
Patriot frontrunners would root for Ted Bundy if he could play live. Lockdown corner.
Jeffrey Chidiha joining us for a few more moments.
I think the fact that Bill Belichick is more involved after Brian Flores went to Miami to coach that dog crap team that I think is scarier now than it.
Right.
Email.
Beaks. Lipo doctor. In a world of suck.
Living in a world of suck.
Like he's there to suck all the fat out. Jake in NYC. New York City. Is on Beaks now.
One of my calls got 1,000 views on YouTube and your last two still ain't equaled that yet.
You got 25 followers, bro. I was trying to get you to 30.
I don't know if this Drizzle guy is good or not, but I do know Drizzle is the stupidest name I've ever heard.
Poor little bird slammed right into our sliding glass door. Dead. Thought of you, Hawk.
You want another one?
You want to do a 2-hour show?
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds good. I think I'll do a 2-hour show.
You got one more right there.
Yeah, well, you're doing a 4-hour show.
Instead of going to prison, you'll come here.
Ask again, it'll be back up to 5.
Not even close.
5.
You got it.
5 hours and a Scrub Saturday show.
I know.
He's leaping over the pile. It's loose. It's rolling. And Chicago is
trying
recovered.
To go over the top for first down, but in reality, he was just handing the ball to Chicago.
Here, you want this?
I don't want it. I don't need it. It's a high school move.
There ain't no magic sauce.
Brandon Tierney, before I let you go, let's talk about the Jets again.
You want the honest answer? I was sitting in my man cave with my 4-year-old son, and I'm saying to myself, why the hell am I subjecting this young man to this team? Well, Jim, why am I doing it to this kid?
Basically, their persona is that of a 2-day-old wet smashed birthday cake that sat in the garbage can upside down in a...
Bad call.
I've got a feeling
Buffalo's going to the Super Bowl.
Don't hurt the real journalism world. It's jackasses like you.
Michael Ray Gundy, if you need him. And honestly, I think we all do. You gotta love when a college coach is a better steward to journalism than an accredited AP journal.
Okay, thank you.
Anytime. My pleasure. No problem. Happy to do it.
You bet.
I'm talking to Johnny Davis.
So I never played. I told my mom I'd be good and didn't want to go back to the park and play baseball no more.
Jonathan Taylor is my guest. What kind of things should my son be looking forward to as a Badger?
He should definitely be looking forward to Mifflin. He should be looking forward to Sunroom Cafe, old-fashioned, and the snowball fight on the Battle of Bascom. When it starts snowing out, they usually do that.
He'll put a towel on, kind of spanking himself as he emulates riding the horse.
Emmett Smith's an all-time great, but even Emmett couldn't wrap up in a towel, giddy up and spank himself. About them Cowboys. We're joined by Eli Drinkwitz.
That introduction, that song got me fired up, man. It's, to be on your radio show is a huge honor.
This is what a yard call sounds like. Yay, I made it, Rome.
And the crowd hates that call.
Dave Roberts.
Romy, my brother, I'm doing well. I'm on my way to San Francisco.
But from here on out, Romy, I need you guys to call me the bread man.
If that's what you want to call Kyle, I can go along with that. But I'm going to open it up to you. Hit me up.
Skid mark, banana nut, up the tailpipe, bread man.
Yeast infection.
Say the pinched loaf.
Come on, Jared.
Jared Allen.
Oh, no, you know, Sundays are always fun, right? But if I had to go to the track of the training camp, I'd probably blow my L5 for a third time.
It is intercepted on the
last night, they looked like a 17-year-old dork trying to lose his V-card. Had 4 chances on the 1, just couldn't score. Ba-dum-bang.
If Brady played in the 80s, he would have been the second coming of Gary Hogaboom.
Wendy's Spicy Nuggets. Here for a limited time.
Spicy Nuggets are back.
I don't have any money. I just...
Yikes.
You throw?
Oh, bad call.
Living in a world of suck.
Yeah, don't be a stranger. Call me back.
London Flector.
Kick your ass.
Yeah, Brad. Boy.
I'm like Aguilar.
You bet.
Good night now!
Rick in Buffalo. What's up, big dude?
I haven't slept all week, Jim, and I still have the energy of 75,000 screaming lunatics. As I said Monday, I'm not worried about the X's and O's this Sunday. I have zero interest in who wins and who loses. I'm looking for one thing and one thing only, retribution. I haven't forgot about the cheap shot that roided up meathead Gronkowski. Took it Trey White a couple years ago, and it's never too late for revenge. I want Jerry Hughes playing the role of Packers legend Charles Martin and turning Tom Brady into his very own Jim McMahon. Now let me explain this for you, Patriots front runners, because I know you weren't watching football in the 80s. November 23rd, 1986. Green Bay defensive end Charles Martin body slammed Bears quarterback Jim McMahon about 10 minutes after the whistle. And that bitch McMahon had it coming for running his mouth all week. I'm no dummy, Jim. This league set up for the Patriots to win every week. Look no further than the refs telling every opposing defense, stay off our lover boy Tommy. And the reason Brady's bitching about all the holding calls is because he knows his interior linemen have held on every play since 2001. And enough of the crap about that bitch boy being the greatest ever. I'll take Fouts, Montana, Marino, Kelly, Aikman, and Elway every day of the friggin' week. They played in the golden era of the 7-step drop. Hanging in the pocket till the last possible second and throwing the football more than 6 yards down the friggin' field. when football was really football. If Brady played in the 80s, he would have been the second coming of Gary Hogaboom. War a Sunday afternoon barroom brawl, breaking out at the Ralph. War affecting the head. War the $200 bounty Buddy Ryan put on Luis and Dejas back in 89. And war the NFL finally getting it right and giving Steve Tasker his gold jacket. 89, bottom line. Talk to you Monday, Jim. That's if I survive the weekend. 50-50 at best. Thanks for the vine. I'm out.
Rock him.
Good night now.